Welcome to the Meb Faber Show, where the focus is on helping you grow and preserve your wealth. Join us as we discuss the craft of investing and uncover new and profitable ideas, all to help you grow wealthier and wiser. Better investing starts here.
Meb Faber is the co-founder and chief investment officer at Cambria Investment Management. Due to industry regulations, he will not discuss any of Cambria's funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Cambria Investment Management or its affiliates. For more information, visit CambriaInvestments.com.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Global Financial Data. We've been using data series from GFD for almost 10 years, ever since I wrote my first white paper. The data has been vital in our research in areas such as Cape ratio calculations and historical simulations. For almost 20 years now, Global Financial Data has been aggregating and transcribing data from original sources with many sources no other data provider has published before. Please have a look at their website at globalfinancialdata.com for more info and to set up a trial account. If you mention that I sent you, they're offering a 20% discount on all new business subscriptions. Again, that's globalfinancialdata.com. Hey, everybody. We are coming back after a two-week podcast vacation. Been doing a lot of traveling, but super excited today to be welcoming local friend and longtime market historian and trader, John Bollinger. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me, Meb.
So despite the fact that we both live in the same town in Manhattan Beach, you and I both fairly often are traveling. You do quite a bit of international. Where you been lately? You've been home for the holidays and New Year? You've been on the road?
I have been home for the holidays. Last year, I don't know, China, Japan, Europe a couple times. You know, there's a lot of interest in my work, so people are very anxious to meet me and, you know, get the word, so to speak.
And historically, that's been a lot in Asia, too, right? I mean, in Japan and in China, both?
Actually, Asia, there's tremendous interest, not only in Bollinger Bands and the related tools mm-hmm. and such like that, but in technical analysis in general. Japan has a very long and deep history in technical analysis. And in China, where, you know, things aren't as clear as they might be because of government ownership of securities and such like that, and government control of the markets, so you often can't see the traditional fundamental values at work. Technical analysis has assumed a sort of primacy amongst investors.
You know, and I was going to ask this later in the chat, but since it's come up already, you know, I've known you for a long time, and one of the things that's always impressed me is that you have a deep interest in not just research history, but market history and writers and, you know, not just, you look like you read a lot of these academic studies and they'll talk about, you know, momentum and reference all the studies in the 90s. But I've been talking to you for years and you'll talk about, you know, looking back to one of the true sort of market historians who've kind of been the biggest influences on how you think about markets and looking back on kind of the ways that you've developed as both a researcher and money manager in general.
Well, I think a guy who was at the peak of his career a century ago by the name of Richard D. Wyckoff, probably the most important person, I think, in the history of technical analysis, not just in terms of his impact on me, but he developed many of the concepts that we think about today in terms of implementing modern technical analysis, even in terms of quantitative analysis, this idea of trying to identify supply and demand, trying to identify what sort of actors there are in the markets and what their conflicting motives are. You know, he was thinking about these things at the turn of last century, started chalking, you know, prices up on the board as you might imagine, but really got into the analytics of it. And eventually founded a school. It's called the Stock Market Institute, and edited a magazine for a long time, the Wall Street Analyst. But he was just such a deep thinker that the concepts that he put forward a century ago are still relevant today. And that's often what you get from studying the history of technical analysis. You find guys who just saw things so clearly and so profoundly that even though the times have changed and the markets have changed and dozens of other things have changed, the basic concepts are still viable.
And so for someone who's interested in Wyckoff's work, do I remember, did he write some books or are there books about him that would recommend? What's a good starting point there?
He wrote one book under a pseudonym. The pseudonym was Rollo Tape. following the tape back in those days was a big thing. And he wrote three or four more books under his own name. Mm-hmm. But if you can get copies of his magazines, and they're still around in libraries here and there. It's not that hard to find. Many of them have been microwaved and microfilmed, I'm sorry.
Probably microwaved as well.
Yeah. So, you know, that material is available. Those are fascinating. He wrote in-depth articles, you know, as he was developing his concepts. And you can see how he would work through ideas about how the markets worked and such like that. And that's exactly the same thing that we do today. Obviously, we have different markets, but the process, the analytical process was the same.
You know, it's funny because we often talk about a similar thing on this podcast, which is, you know, a lot of people talk about value and we say, look, that Ben Graham was talking about that 100 years ago as well. And talk about trend with Charles Dow. And a lot of these guys that at least were talking about these things, it's nothing particularly that, you know, a lot of this audience is younger, don't necessarily know that a lot of the concepts have been around for a really long time. And we'll link to the Wyckoff magazine and books in the show notes we publish. Is there anyone else off the top of your head that there's been a big influence, you know, over the years in your thinking?
Well, you just mentioned another one, Charles Dow. He was sort of the grandfather of trend following. He, developed ideas about trend following 120 years ago or so. And, the editor of Barron's, which was another paper that he owned at the time, Hamilton, William Peter Hamilton, took those ideas and codified them in a long series of editorials that basically are the foundations of trend following investing as it exists today.
You know, it's funny because we had taken a look back and said Dow theory, there's a lot of ways to interpret it, but at its simplest kind of, is a market going up? And he was looking at the industrials and transports, I believe. And we would say even something if you simply just overlaid a moving average on each. And so when they were agreement, they actually had the best performance, you know, when it was mixed, not as good. And they were both in downtrends, the worst.
So, exactly.
It just held out so well out of sample over 100 years later.
Exactly. In 1930 or so, Robert Ray, who was the person who kind of codified all of Dow's and Hamilton's work, he suggested using the simple 5% filter, just take, mm-hmm. you know, the prior highs. And anytime you fall 5% from them, you mark that average as being in a downtrend. You keep track of three or four or five averages, and you know, when they're all in uptrends, the market's doing well. When they're mixed, the market's going sideways. When they're all in downtrends, well, you know what's happening then too.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Keep it simple. Well, before we start bouncing around a little bit more, you know, looking back in history, let's take a look at Bollinger's history. You know, you were originally born in Vermont, right?
I am.
And, you know, didn't start out in LA as a trader and market historian, right? Do I remember correctly?
You remember exactly correctly. I was in the film business, mm-hmm. as a cameraman. I went to the School of Visual Arts in New York and went to apprenticed to a cinematographer, which is something I would do again later in the markets. Apprenticed to a very fine cinematographer, a guy by the name of David Quaid. Some people will know that name. It's sort of a cinematographer's cinematographer. And spent the first 10 years of my career in the film business, which is what moved me from New York to LA, the sorts of films and the sort of work that I wanted to do. There was more of it here than there was in New York. So that moved me out here. But all along, I'd had interest in markets, and my mom was getting ready to retire. She ran a small advertising agency, and she asked me, she knew I was interested in stock market stuff like that. She asked me to look after her investments, and I quickly learned how hard that was and started focusing on ways that I might do that better, and started learning about technical analysis and such, and gradually transitioned from film to the markets by the time I was about 30.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I remember correctly, you started spending a little time on not working the camera, but in front of the camera, the predecessor to CNBC. What was that called?
It was the Financial News Network.
Okay.
It's actually a funny story. There was a guy on the radio here in LA by the name of Ed Hart. And in 5 minutes in the morning, he could tell you everything you needed to know for the day about the markets, what to look at, what stocks to follow, what areas were hot, what areas were not. He was just really incredible. The Financial News Network had just started up. It was the first cable network that was ever devoted to the stock market. And they asked him to come down and work with them. And they had asked me about 6 months prior. And I was very happy doing what I was doing. I was trading options at the time. I turned them down. But when I heard Ed Hart had gone to work for them, I said, well, if it's good enough for Ed, it's good enough for me. So I went down and asked the guy if the job was still open, and it still was. They were interested in somebody who could provide some technical content on air, and they had actually some very sophisticated computer systems that they had built up to analyze the markets. The chairman of the board, a guy by the name of Earl Bryan, had written a master's thesis on technical analysis and implemented it on mainframe computers. So there was sort of a liking of technical analysis at the network that came from the top down. So it was very easy for me to integrate in, and I started behind the scenes providing material for other people. And then oddly enough, one day they were short a person, and the guy came in and said, "You go out there." At the time, I was terrible. I had terrible stage fright. I was stuttering.
Find some old tapes of this? Are they archived somewhere?
Oh, yeah. There's plenty of embarrassing material around. But, they liked the content that I provided. If they didn't like my delivery, and they put up with me long enough for me to make the transition to being a fairly smooth provider.
It takes practice. And so... would this have been around the same time, or would it have preceded or been in parallel with when you really started developing Bollinger Bands? Because I know it's been about 30 years, right-ish?
Actually, it's coming up on 34.
Oh, man. So, but was it around the same time as the team?
Actually, I had just developed Bollinger Bands when I went to the Financial News Network, and probably in the prior 6 to 8 months. I went in 84. And I did the final touches of Bollinger Bands as they are today, probably 1983, started on them in 1982. You have to remember, this was in the era before there were PCs. So we had we called them microcomputers, but they're just basically the predecessor of the PC. You had to piece them together, cards. You'd buy memory cards and stuff like that and put them together. But I had put one of those together, and I had an early spreadsheet program called SuperCalc. I'm sure somebody in the audience will remember that. It was for the old CPM operating system, and I was trading options at the time. And in order to trade options, the one thing you have to have is an estimate of volatility. So one day I copied the formula for volatility down a column in the spreadsheet, and I saw that it was changing over the time. And you know, that doesn't sound very interesting now, but in 1982, we believed volatility was a static quantity. It was like a property, like the wall is white or the car is blue. Mm-hmm. You know, IBM's beta is 1.2, that sort of thing. And it was just about then that Robert Engel was doing his work, which he did eventually get the Nobel Prize for his work on the fact that volatility was volatile. So it was in the air, that sort of idea. And I had a trading system that I was using that used fixed parameters, and you're constantly having to readjust them. It was a nightmare. And every time you readjust them, you'd let motions into the marketplace. If you're bullish, you'd adjust them so it looked bullish. Mm-hmm. If you're bearish, you'd adjust them so it looked bearish. I was looking for some way to automate that process. And seeing volatility change, I said, maybe I can use volatility. And that was the genesis of Bollinger Bands.
And so the quick definition of what they are for people, if there's someone who's been in a closet that's listening to this podcast, and what's the quick definition of Bollinger Bands and the quick overview, kind of in your opinion, from the creator of the best way to use them?
So Bollinger Bands are just a type of trading bands. All trading bands are more or less the same in their concept. They provide a relative definition of what's high and low. If you're near the upper band, prices are relatively high. If you're near the lower band, prices are relatively low. Bollinger Bands are a sort of trading man that's driven by volatility. That was my contribution to the process. And so they're automated. You don't have to adjust them. You don't have to change them. You don't have to maintain them as the market regime changes. The Bollinger Bands change. They tighten. They expand. They're driven by a middle band. There's three lines, upper, middle, and lower. So the middle band is a moving average. So if stocks are trending up, the bands are rising. If stocks are trending down, the bands are falling. And they provide that key definition of whether prices are relatively high or relatively low. And you can use that to assemble all sorts of trading approaches. You can use them in pattern recognition to try to rigorously define W bottoms or M-type tops. You can use them to, you know, identify oversold and overbought opportunities. You can use them in trend following methods or, you know, you can, in congestion range markets, you can use them as buy and sell levels to reverse to the other side of the range.
One of the beauties of publishing like you have for so long, you also have to be one of the longest continual newsletter writers, right? Your Capital Growth, rather. When did you start that? In the 80s as well?
Actually, it started in 87, not an auspicious year.
Well, it depends. You may have started in November or earlier in the year. But so you've been writing for a long time. And one of the beauties of writing, and John also does a lot of speeches around the world and videos, many videos that are probably people have seen, DVDs, a bunch of websites, Bollinger Bands, and a whole book on the topic, Bollinger on Bollinger Bands. But one of the cool things about publishing is other people taking your work and kind of running with it. What have you seen as kind of some innovative or interesting ways that people have kind of built upon it and used it in ways you might not have even considered over the years? And have you incorporated any of those methods? And
so I was like one of the original open source guys. Mm-hmm. When I developed the bands, I immediately put them out in the public domain and allowed other people share the formulation with them and allowed other people to use them to incorporate them into their software and into their platforms. And the benefit of that is astonishing because over the years, people will come to you and they say, look, I've taken your work and I've done these fantastic things with it. I remember the first time that it really occurred to me what a treasure trove this sort of additional information was in Hong Kong many, many years ago. A Chinese guy who was running some active trading approaches inside a hedge fund was using Bollinger Bands on the equity curves of the different approaches to allocate funds between the approaches. If the equity curve were trending up toward the upper Bollinger Band, he would take money away from it and put money into a system that was trending down toward the lower Bollinger Band. So he used it to allocate funds within a fund. It was just amazing.
Which is funny because it's the exact opposite what we've seen in the literature of what most individuals and institutions want to do, which is put money into the funds that are doing well and take money out of the performance chase, right?
Well, you know, Humphrey Neal, the founder of Contrarian Opinion, said you should do the opposite. And I found out in my career more often than not that he was correct.
And so any kind of general, having been working with these 30 years, any general ways that your thinking has changed on using them in general? Is there any major kind of takeaways that you use now that you wouldn't have maybe 30 years ago?
Well, the first thing is the bands themselves haven't changed. They've withstood the test of time. The basic idea turned out to be a first principles sort of idea, mm-hmm. a robust idea that's as usable today as it was when I developed them. I've added some extra indicators over the years that are related to them, but other than that, they haven't changed very much. In terms of my approach to using them, the very first system that I built to use the bands, the system existed before the bands, the very first system I modified to use the bands, I still use today.
So some things
have stood the test of time. Some things haven't stood the test of time because market dynamics have changed a lot. I think years ago, it was a much simpler proposition, especially when trading individual stocks, to simply try to sell the upper band and try to buy the lower band. I think the sort of success rate of that was much higher years ago. And I think you need to be more sophisticated. You have to bring a little bit more to the party these days. You have to add, you know, some supply demand information, or some market trend information, or some group and sector information. You have to add a little bit more if you want to be as
that is a perfect lead in to kind of the next topic that I would like to talk about. And, you know, so many investors in our world are severely what I like to call siloed. You know, they say, "Mate, look, I'm a dividend guy, or I'm a pure trend follower," and that's fine. I think there's many approaches in markets that work, and you know, if people find the one that they're attracted to, God bless them. But one of the things you're known for is an investing concept that is probably considered to be accepted today, but may not have been necessarily the time, which is kind of combining this juncture overlap between technical analysis, which is study of price trends, supply and demand, but also fundamental analysis, and which you called rational analysis, which makes so much sense. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. How do you kind of arrive at putting those? And by the way, John has to be one of the first CFAs, CMTs. There can't be too many of y'all around, right?
No, there's actually a lot of us now, but I am the first.
First ever?
I'm the first ever by simple default. When they gave the first CMT exam, that's chartered market technician, I was the only CFA that took it.
That's funny. That's awesome. That's a really cool piece of trivia. I didn't know that. So there's got to be more now just because there's so many CFAs. But for a lot of people, it's kind of like holding two very different beliefs in their head, you know, and so the prospect of using fundamentals and technicals, it's a little more accepted now. But so how'd you kind of come around to that way of thinking? Was it, and maybe talk a little bit about it, about how you possibly use the two of those together in investing approaches?
Well, first, it doesn't have to lead to cognitive dissonance. These things can be complementary. They don't have to fight with one another. You know, I started the way that most people do, taking brokerage research and trying to make money out of that, stock tips from, you know, brokerage house and stuff like that. Obviously, that doesn't work. Didn't work then, doesn't work now, And then I shifted to technical analysis. But I was always impressed by, back in the day, stock quotes are very hard to come by. It was very expensive. If you wanted quotes in your home, you got this thing that was the size of a refrigerator, had to have plumbing, you know, to keep it cool. It was crazy. So most people who were involved in the markets would go to a brokerage firm, and brokerage firms would give active traders desks, just give them to you, you know, and obviously you had to generate commissions to get one. So the idea was that I would look at this, the firm that gave me a desk was firm that no longer exists called A.G. Becker. And they had really terrific research. I mean, really terrific research, both fundamental research and technical research, which was very unusual for a firm in those days. And I would look at it and I would just go, you know, all of this is pretty good. And if you put the pieces together, it's even better. They had a woman there by the name of Elaine Garzarelli, who did a great group and sector product. They had a guy by the name of Roy Bloomberg, who did a great technical analysis and options product, and it had a number of great fundamental analysts. So if you could put all those parts and pieces together, you could actually gain an edge. So that's the juncture of that idea. Today, you know, it's not just technical analysis and fundamental analysis. Today, we've got four parts to the puzzle, right? There's quantitative analysis, behavioral finance, technical analysis, and fundamental analysis. So you can steal from all those different disciplines, take little pieces that work and combine them into an approach that works better than any single one of those approaches individually.
And so how do you, kind of your process, how do you decide from which toolkit to draw? How do you put it all together? Do you have a systematic way about it, or what's kind of the combination? How do you go about it?
So, the thing that, you know, that I like the most, or the things that I like the most, are like group and sector analysis. I think this is a very powerful concept. Most people would regard that as some form of fundamental analysis. I don't actually know how it should be labeled. But I combine that with technicals, with momentum and such. I'm very interested in growth. I think there are times when the market values growth very highly. There are times when the market discounts growth. So that rotation between styles, between growth and value, between large cap and small cap and such like that, that's a very big piece of my process. Today, that would be called quantitative analysis. Back in the day, it was called technical analysis. Mm-hmm. So that there's an interesting idea there is that, you know, these pieces have been shuffled around over the years. Different groups have claimed different pieces. Much of what we know as behavioral finance today came from Kahneman and Tversky, from their pioneering work. But a lot of it came from the work of a guy by the name of Humphrey Neal, who was another Vermonter, right? They called him the Vermont Ruminator. And he developed this whole idea, contrary opinion, that the crowd could be wrong, that people would go to excess, and that you know, there were times when you should be in tune with the crowd and follow the trends, and there were times when you absolutely should not, and you should go the other way. So, you know, the history of people making, you know, efforts at analysis in this market is littered with people who combine these ideas. It is nothing that I came up with. It's an idea, you know, that has tremendous depth in terms of history.
Yeah, I mean, it's a scenario we often talk about, that my favorite type of investment is if you were to distill it down to the two most simplest, would be something that's cheap and entering an uptrend. If I had to pick one thing, and it's interesting because that's not the way the world has looked on kind of a country or sector level for a while, but it seems to have been changing in the past few months, where a lot of what you would assume would be the cheaper sectors, industries, countries have really started having great performance over the past 6 months. But for the prior years, I mean, the U.S. has been the number one stock performer since the bottom of the crisis, and the cheap stuff has just gotten cheaper. But that's what creates opportunity. What where are you kind of seeing opportunity now in the groups and sectors? Is it
so? Just to hook back into that for a second, there's this guy by the name of Bukowski. You know, he devoted the best part of a book to exploring exactly those kinds of ideas. I think they're really fantastic ideas.
What's the book? Do you know?
What Works on Wall Street.
We'll get back to books in a little bit. So I don't know if you can share this or not, but is there anywhere like in kind of your research that you're seeing opportunity now? Any groups, any sectors off the top of your head?
Well, in the short to intermediate term, telecom.
Which, by the way, sorry, that's a terrible question to ask. And one of the worst things about TV is, you know, there's no time frame. And you actually had a good quote, not to interrupt you, in one of your pieces talking about time frame confusion. You know, where people will look at a shorter term chart, but be trading on a longer term time horizon, or be trading on a longer term time horizon, and but only looking at short term charts. So that
comes from a whole idea I did about task analysis. Mm-hmm. Right, there are certain things that we need to attach our analytical tasks to the appropriate time frames. Long term is our background. It's what's happening in the world. It's, you know, is money supply growing? You know, are we in a secular economic uptrend? That sort of thing. Intermediate term is this sort of stuff we've been talking about: growth versus value. What groups and sectors are doing well? What groups and sectors are doing poorly? What countries are uptrending? What countries are downtrending? All that. And short term is really only for execution. Mm-hmm. And the classic mistake that people make is they make a decision in the intermediate term. They say, well, I like France, and inside France, I like the technology stocks. I mean, all the parts and pieces are fitting together. So they go to the short term to execute and get their positions and stuff like that, tick charts and all that stuff, looking at quotes. And they get their positions, and they don't revert back to the intermediate term to analyze them. They just watch it go tick, 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 tick. And, of course, when something's going tick, 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 it goes tick, 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 tick against you, and you're flushed out and you walk away. But we had no reason to be flushed out, because your reasons from the intermediate term were still valid. So you should have held on to that position. So people have this time frame confusion that I think does a huge amount of damage.
And we see that not just with trading, but also investing, where so many people will come to me or having conversations with, say they have a long-term investing horizon or plan, and then will often really operate on their emotions and psychology on the time frame of weeks and months. Uh-huh. And you know, that like you mentioned, becomes the biggest problem on you know, getting caught up in the emotions, but really losing sight of the long term.
The 300-pound gorilla that's sitting in the corner is wearing a sign that says discipline.
That's Jeff, by the way. For the podcast listeners, Jeff's in the corner. Just kidding. I wish Jeff was in here right now because he loves trading options, and he would love to hear some of this. Yeah, discipline is the hardest part. So so along with the trading, and there's, you know, I know you've talked a lot historically about position sizing, and what's your opinion on, say, stop losses or how to exit trades? What's your in general approach to once you put on a trade? Is it a defined exit? What's your opinion?
So many parts and pieces there. First of all, if I had, you know, for the typical person who's an active investor and or trader, there's no question in my mind that the greatest thing that is neglected is position sizing. Okay, you've got an idea, how much do you put to work? And you need to have a way to quantify that. You can go to Ralph Vince's work if you want, or there are any number of other people who have written on the topic. I don't think it really matters that much which of the approaches you use, as long as you use one.
Mm-hmm.
All right? I mean, as long as you have a rational idea, because the problem is, Here's how the problem typically works out. You have a very elegant approach to the markets. It generates, say, 17% a year on average with mm-hmm. a relatively small deviation. Mm-hmm. And so you need to know how much of your capital to commit to that. The problem is that there is, in fact, a mathematically optimal amount, say mm-hmm. 7% or 10 or 15 or 20, whatever it is, that you should commit to that approach. The problem is that on the downside, it doesn't matter that much. You just earn a little bit less. So if the optimal position size is 15% and you're 13% or 12% or 11%, you're just going to earn a little bit less. You're going to give up a little bit of your edge. The problem is on the other side. At 16%, you're going to earn a lot less. And at 17%, you're going to earn even more less. And that curve goes down really steeply, right? So the problem is betting too large, not betting too small. Betting too small, you give up some of the edge that you've developed. You're not going to make as much money as you should. But if you're over the peak of that curve, if you're betting too large for your win-loss ratio, for your system dynamics, the risk of ruin rises abruptly. And that's something I don't think that people realize.
And the interesting thing about this, too, is that that's assuming you actually can quantify the worst-case scenario. And a lot of times, the classic trading phrase is, your worst drawdown is always in your future. So for a game like blackjack, it's probably easy to quantify the correct betting size, but investment markets, it's a little harder. And this is, I mean, believe me.
And that's why I said it doesn't really matter which approach you use, as long as you use some approach so you have an idea of where that peak is. And you can, you know, assure that you're on this side of the peak, the safe side of the peak, not the dangerous side of the peak.
You know, it's hard to kind of describe this, and the younger investors listening to this that haven't had that really painful trade. You know, I learned this lesson a couple times in my early 20s trading, blowing up an entire account to where, you know, with that same thing, taking way too much risk on one investment. And you learn that lesson once, you know, you feel the very real visceral pain of losing money, and it colors you for forever. And so, but you see this take place in echoes where people who haven't had that, and the probably worst thing that could ever happen to a young trader is a string of successful trades.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. Especially if they're their first, second, third, and fourth trades.
Yeah. And that's why I became a quant. It said, you know, oh my God, I clearly, you know, have no idea how to position size or how to place these bets. And so it's something that, you know, drove me into quantitative analysis because of the too much risk. But we see it all the time. I mean, I even had a young lady from Australia email me today and she says, hey, Meb, you know, I invest this, that and the other, but I just really hate drawdowns. And I said, well, look, you should probably be happily sitting CDs and just move on. You know, you should be in very short-term bonds and just be happy with it. Or, you know, say maybe half in cash. But the worst case scenario for that type of person is taking on too much risk. And for the younger generation who, for right now, for the past 8 years, has never seen a bear market in the U.S., you know, the expectations start to get out of line. So we always tell people to try to err on the side of caution. Try to look for what would be optimal and then kind of back away a little bit.
So I run a little open source project. It's a Python. It's written in the Python programming language, and what it does is it takes your trading stats, whether they can be long term, short term, it doesn't matter, and it visualizes them for you so that you can see them. Probably has a dozen different graphing styles, and it really lets you see the dynamics of the decisions that you're making and what they look like. And one of them that's really interesting that people find totally counterintuitive, but once they've seen it, they never forget it, is called regret. And this is simply the amount of time that you spend in drawdown, the percentage of the time you are in drawdown. Right. And people, if you intuitively ask them how much of the time are you in regret, they say, oh, maybe 10, 15% of the time. It's like 80, 90% of the time for most people. Because the number of days that you are making new highs on your equity curve, those are the only days in which you're not in drawdown.
Mm-hmm. We actually wrote a post on this, not on the trading, but applied to the broad indices, called something like, to be a good investor, you have to be a good loser. And it was looking, I think, even at the S&P, and it says there's only two possible states, all-time high or drawdown, nothing in between. And if I may get this wrong, I'll post it to the show notes, but I think the S&P was like 60 or 70% of the time in a drawdown, right? Like you're,
oh, it's got to be higher than that.
Yeah, all-time high is a kind of a rare event. And so,
because even if you make an all-time high, tomorrow you're down to, right, you know, down a tick, and that's a drawdown day.
And that's hard for people.
It's very hard for people. And that's why we did System View, so that you could just take your trading stats and plug them in, and it'll graph them out, and you can see this stuff. And there's no, you know, it's so enlightening. When people, first time people see it, they go, it's like somebody turned the lights on in the room.
Mm-hmm. And can this be accessed through the Bollinger Band's website?
No, it's on GitHub.
GitHub. All right. Well, we'll post a link if we can find it. But by the way, listeners, there's a massive amount of research is on Bollinger Band's website. I assume if you're probably like me and just looking at the website, I imagine the vast majority of the tools which you built on the website, which is a lot, I imagine a lot of those you built for yourself because there was nothing else out there.
Actually, we have several websites. The big analytical one is the same title as my book, Bollinger on Bollinger Bands. It's got a short name, bbands.com. Mm-hmm. But that was totally built to allow me to trade. Mm-hmm. That and, you know, its sister site is a group and sector analytical site. Mm-hmm. Those two sites were 100% built to allow me to trade. And, you know, actually, you were touching on this before when you asked me about my newsletter. I write my newsletter for myself. It's a discipline. I don't write it for other people. Mm-hmm. Every month I have to sit down and I have to do that. It takes me a week. It's when I do my deepest thinking. It's when I do, you know, when I'm forced to put all everything together and make it in black and white.
And you're now publishing on Wednesdays, I think, right?
Yeah.
Because originally it was on, like, for weekend delivery. Do you even mail it anymore, or is it just electronic?
No, just electronic.
Yeah, the world's changing.
No more paper.
Yeah, no, I mean, so it's funny because the reason that I started writing on the blog years ago, similar to what you were talking about, was to try to find feedback on a couple ideas, and very just rudimentary ideas that I couldn't find, you know, being a quant, kind of being, you know, the sitting in the corner in a dark room, not having the interaction or the resources, said, hey, look, who else is thinking about this and published it, ended up, same sort of thing, ended up having to build it on your own, but you got a lot of the feedback. And that, to me, has been a much better resource. But the writing, certainly, I think, is a wonderful process to try to really learn what you think.
You know, that feedback process is so important. When I started, it was very hard. No internet, obviously, or mm-hmm. anything like that. So it was very hard to find other people you could talk to and such like that, especially being out here on the West Coast, away from the financial centers mm-hmm. And such, although we had a vibrant financial center here in L.A. at the time. It was still hard to find people and books. You know, there was a guy by the name of Needham. He ran a company called Needham Book Finders, and you'd call him up and you'd say, oh, I want a copy of Robert Ray's The Tao Theory. And he'd say, fine, you know, I'll give you a call in a couple of weeks. And, you know, he'd call you back and he'd say, pick it up at this antique store. And, you know, you'd go. You know, it's like sort of like buying drugs.
You know what this reminds me of? So I just forgot about this. Is that I used to go over and would pester John because there was, he had archived, some would call it hoarding, maybe your wife would call it hoarding, archived Barron's magazines for, I mean, how long do you have them? Do you still have them?
Nope.
What? What'd you do with them?
I gave them to the MTA library.
Okay, so good. I thought you were going to say use them as kindling and firewood.
No.
I had a number of models that I built off Nelson's Freeberg work that were data series that had only, to my knowledge, only existed in Barron's, and John had many, many years. So I spent a handful of days in a storage room writing down all the data from John's Barron's.
I still keep a big database from mm-hmm. Barron's. Each week I enter a whole bunch of numbers out of Barron's. Very useful.
And I remember Ralph Vince used to keep a good spreadsheet there. And there's a lot of ideas that I think are kind of that econometric, rational analysis time series that I think are really fascinating. That there's a handful of other people that do some similar work there too, but is an area I used to spend so much time in. Fosbach was a great book back in the day. Stock Market Logic.
Fosbach was a terrific guy. I mean, he was a really deep thinker, and he did an incredible work.
And so while we're on the topic of writing and books, and by the way, you probably know this, but my first white paper was actually written to avoid taking the CMT level 3. It was the only reason I wrote it, was because they were getting rid of the paper requirement. I said, oh my God, I don't want to take the test. And so actually wrote, I had never written a paper before and wrote a paper and long, that's actually going to be 10 years anniversary, I think, this month. Anyway, let's talk about books for a second, because you're a big market historian and kind of thinking. And who are some other books that younger investors may not know about, or books that you maybe have most gifted to people other than Bollinger & Bollinger Bands, but some really good books that have been influential to you? Any other ideas off the top of your head?
So there was a statistician at GE by the name Arthur A. Merrill, and he retired at 65, as you know, was the way in those days. And he started a second career as a market technician. He wrote so concisely and beautifully. It was astonishing. So anything you can find by Arthur Merrill, very, you know, it's sort of hard to find, but it's in the libraries. It's about any of his work is really terrific. Just to see how his mind worked and how he thought about markets. Another, you know, sort of more contemporary guy is a fund manager by the name of Martin Zweig. Mm-hmm. He had a couple of books, Winning on Wall Street mm-hmm. and Winning with the New IRAs, I think it was.
Yeah, it's sitting on the shelf in my brother's house. I remember that book.
Yeah, yeah. So those books are chock full of interesting ideas.
What do you think about some more? We can talk about it. Let me know. Those are some great ones. I was going to jokingly, when you said the interestingly thing about Los Angeles, I said we're going to, in the next couple months, host some sort of fintech happy hour meetup. So we'll let you know whenever that's going to be. And listeners, if you find yourself in LA, we'll post it publicly. You know, so along the books, you know, you have a lot of resources on the website. Any other outside
tools, website, technical analysis, software, things that you use that are think are particularly useful? Or is it all just custom built, coded up by JB?
I do some coding, but really only when there's no alternative. I like to code. You know, it's a nice discipline. I think it's actually good for you. It makes you think in a sort of interesting way. I don't think that it's really essential anymore. There's such powerful tools available. If you're a quant type like yourself, the statistical language R has built a huge thriving community around R and finance, and you know, very helpful people.
Where do people? Is there like a central hub for that? Is it a place you can go, or is it?
There's a group in Chicago, actually called R and Finance. Mm-hmm. They have a website. Mm-hmm. That's a great starting place for that. They're very friendly, very nice, very, very helpful.
That's the good news about the internet these days. You can almost find any type. I mean, R is way above my pay grade. I do as little coding as possible. I think I tapped out on my coding at C++ my freshman year in college. But there's a lot of communities built around basically anything. You know, there's Sum Zero for hedge funds, Value Investing Club for those guys, the Bogleheads who tend to be pleasantly insane about, you know, the Vanguard investing. And then there's a lot of quant finance. Quantopian is a newer one on kind of writing up the algorithm. So there's a lot that we can find out there. One of my favorite things to do when I'm talking to people is I'll go grab their Twitter stream and you can sort them. There's a really terrible design website, but it works. Only one that I know of called Favstar. And you can sort people's tweets by the most popular. And so we took a look at John's and I'm going to read what it seems you're top five, all most popular tweets revolved around Bitcoin.
You know, that's just an accident. I'm very interested in Bitcoin. Yeah. No question about that. But I happened to, early on when I first started on Twitter, mm-hmm. one of the first tweets I ever saw was about Bitcoin. And there's a huge Bitcoin mm-hmm. community on Twitter. I don't mm-hmm. know why. Mm-hmm. There's another huge Bitcoin community on Reddit as well. Mm-hmm. But I just fell into them and, you know, they're sort of kindred spirits. So I random tweets about Bitcoin.
So tell me, do you think one, have you ever owned or traded Bitcoin, or two, do you think it's actually, you know, the same rules apply? Do you think that Bollinger Bands can work on Bitcoin?
Bollinger Bands work fantastic on Bitcoin. And they work fantastic on all Forex.
Yeah. I was going to say currency traders in general, one, lean towards technical analysis in general, but often you hear it in the circles and the vernacular, love using Bollinger.
So there's a reason for that. Currency trading is pairs trading. Mm-hmm. You're long one and short the other, essentially. So sometimes you find a stock you like and a stock you hate and you pair them together and that's a pair. There are portfolios full of pairs trading. The idea is to earn a return at reduced volatility over time. Take out the market factor and just capture the sweetness of your ideas. So Forex is pairs trading, and pairs have a statistical property. They're stationary, or they exhibit in statistical parlance stationarity. And it just turns out that Bollinger Bands and any approach like Bollinger Bands work just a little bit better with series that exhibit stationarity. So it's there's sort of a built-in edge to using Bollinger Bands on anything that's a pair.
That's fascinating. You know, Bitcoin.
And you can create pairs, right? I mean, you can you know, you can be long IJR and short SPY, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you can create all sorts of pairs and then analyze those ratios using Bollinger Bands, and you'll find that there's tremendous value there.
I was listening to, I remember Gunlock, and sometimes pairs make sense to me and sometimes they don't. I remember listening to Gunlock talk about a pair trade once, and what was it? It was like long Apple, short gold, or something vice versa. And I was like, what in the world do those two things have to do with each other? I have no idea, but pairs trading is an interesting area. But Bitcoin is fascinating to me. I've been cheering. I think it's a very interesting diversion. I've never owned one. I don't trade it. But it's a very pleasant distraction.
So we're just coming up on the point where Bitcoin's really going to get tradable. We're going to get a Bitcoin ETF pretty soon, mm-hmm. And that'll be that'll be liquid and in and out, you know, for low commissions and low spreads and blah blah blah. And I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah,
is all I can say. I think it'd be a great trading vehicle.
It's surrounded by so many interesting stories. I mean, the whole Silk Road story that is just, and we'll link to it in the bio. If you've never heard of Silk Road, listeners, there's a great Wired story. I think it's becoming a movie now, straight out of some, you know, science fiction. But Silk Road used to be a marketplace where you could buy and sell anything, but Bitcoin was kind of the perfect currency to do that. And then the founder eventually ended up getting arrested because he was trying to put on hits on people while making tens of millions of dollars each month working from a cafe or like a library.
So that was the founder of
Silk Road,
right, not right. The founder of Bitcoin.
Oh, does Bitcoin have a
there is
acknowledged founder now?
There is a founder, you know. Nobody really, you know, nobody really knows who he is, but we'll put it this way, he was a heck of a coder.
Yeah.
I mean, he's supposedly a Japanese guy. I mean, we'll leave it at that.
I used to joke. I said, I wouldn't be surprised. I would love to hear one day that it turns out that it was the CIA that developed Bitcoin as a way to I mean, you say you can't track it, but to be able to see what's going on with the shady money scenarios. Who knows?
Sense to me.
Yeah. I put it up as a subscription option on the Idea Farm for a while, and no one subscribed. I mean, despite being, you know, in kind of a younger tech crowd in Los Angeles, I don't really know many friends that use it. But then I go to other countries. I mean, I remember I was down in Mexico and was chatting with a fella who has a bunch of Bitcoin ATMs, you know, and that was his business, was putting out Bitcoin ATMs. So
Bitcoin's clearly more popular outside of the States than it is inside the States. And, you know, it's sort of understandable because if you've had currency problems in your life, then the idea of an alternative currency gets much more appealing.
And it's, you know, for someone who travels a lot, I'm sure you see this, you know, we've seen it a lot. In the U.S., most investors don't traditionally think that much about currencies, you know, being the reserve currency, but also the world's biggest economy. Most investors and individuals, the only time they think of currencies is, hey, it's a great time to go skiing in Canada now. It's a great time to go down to Mexico or vice versa when the US dollar is doing poorly. But almost every conversation you have with an international investor is just littered with currency, you know, exposure or ideas. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with many foreign and emerging currencies, you know, can go through periods of huge volatility and drawdowns and everything else involved.
Well, and, you know, we've had the advantage of being able to lend and borrow in our own currency because we've had the reserve currency for so long. You know, most other people in the world have never experienced anything like that. So we have a certain, we perceive the dollar in a way which, frankly, most international investors simply cannot comprehend because they've never had that. So, yeah, you're right. Once you get outside of the States, Forex, the exchange rate, is a huge part of every decision.
you know, in I assume you trade current. I mean, you trade pretty much everything, right? Stocks, currencies. Is that accurate or is that not accurate?
Yeah. Okay. Pretty much. Right. Actually, what I mostly trade is volatility.
Oh, interesting. Man, we're getting late into the podcast for that, but that is a wonderful rabbit hole to start to go down. I mean, what's your general? So when you're trading volatility, is it expressed through options? Or are you trading volatility funds? What are you doing?
So I'm really interested in all the VIX derivatives that we have now. I think they offer, you know, really interesting opportunities. I think the thing about volatility is not so much how you trade it or what you trade. There's many different ways to go after that. Options is how I learned it, but I don't really do that anymore. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about volatility for me is how misunderstood it is. The academic view.
Go on.
Well, the academic view of volatility it just doesn't fit the facts in the marketplace. And since most people are trying to trade it from the academic view, that creates tremendous opportunities if you're willing to sort of look outside the box and take an individual approach to it. So I just think there's tremendous opportunity in volatility today. And I don't think that's going to be arbed away anymore because the academy is so attached to its view of volatility, and they pound it into all the finance students. Everybody comes out with those views, and you know, it's sort of a universal truth, and it just doesn't fit the facts. Mm. I mean, they're nice theories and all that, but they don't fit the facts that we see in the marketplace.
Interesting. I feel like we're going to have you on back on in like 6 months to really go down that rabbit hole. otherwise, we'll be here for 3 hours. Let's start to wind down and do a couple quick questions that we start to ask everyone. And these two I didn't ask John ahead of time, so we're putting him on the spot a little bit.
Uh-oh.
Most memorable trade.
So they tell a story in Chicago. There's a guy with a small G that runs the pits, and he says that he has three rules, and he enforces those rules mercilessly. So you're allowed to buy the bottom tick once in your lifetime. You're allowed to sell the top tick once in your lifetime. Of course, you're free to do the opposite as often as you would like. I once sold the very top tick. It was a stock called Home Shopping Network, and mm-hmm. I shorted it at the all-time high print.
Well, so that's good. You at least know that you've used up that bullet. So
that's right.
You're
that's
like,
right.
I'm done shorting.
So
I'm no longer.
So I have one more opportunity. You know, sometime in the next decade or so, I'll have to find an opportunity to buy the bottom tick. I've never even gotten close to doing that, but it was happenstance. It was not skill or anything like that. I just
never is
just
right?
happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right idea and. Got
yeah,
it.
That's funny. That's the way that it works. Do you have a memorable worst trade?
Yeah, I absolutely have a memorable worst trade. I was pretty active in the CMO markets. Those would be collateralized mortgage obligations when that market blew up. So that was that was a series of really, really awful trades. They all worked out in the end. Mm-hmm. This was before there was credit risk involved in these securities, but these were government securities and such like that, so there was no credit risk. So, in fact, they all worked out in the end, and we were eventually made whole, but... there was some really hard going for a while.
For some reason, I don't know why this popped into my head. It reminds me of going back to your idea on losing, was that the concept of trading systems and designing in kind of whatever you want. And it just this has nothing to do with what you just said, really. But it's you could design a trading system that's not particularly profitable, but has a 90 some percent win rate, which is
to buy a security and exit on the first profitable trade. You know, uh-huh. And that has like a 90, if you want a great exit and want them to be certain, but
so your numbers are all drawdown in one little profit.
Well, the one that's in a drawdown, this is probably a great newsletter, you know, usage for the little bit of the sketchier ones, is you could have like a 97% win rate by just never closing out the losing trade.
So, you know, there are people who actually do this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's as fantastic as it seems. I actually know somebody who does this.
No, I mean, look, there's even many legitimate ways. We were talking about this with some friends about the, you know, even the investment side. There's plenty of legitimate ways to build track records that, you know, are accurate, but not necessarily ethical. Right. And this goes on in the newsletter where it goes on everywhere, but there's, you know, as always, buyer beware. Again, going down a whole nother rabbit hole. All right. Last question. We ask everyone something beautiful, useful, somewhat magical, maybe that people may or may not know about. You got something for us?
Well, about 7 or 8 years ago, I started to design and build tube amplifiers. It's vacuum tube amplifiers, as in the sort of stereo equipment that was popular in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and into the 60s when the transistor finally took over and solid state amps took over. So I find these things to be absolutely magical. If you get a really well set up tube amp, vacuum tube amp, and a couple of nice speakers, and a good recording, and you have yourself a time machine.
Mm.
You can get transported back to that moment in time. You can be there.
What, and so give me a little bit. This is just for listening to music?
For listening to music.
And what's your go-to style?
Oh, I listen. I'm an incredibly eclectic music listener, but I probably listen to more jazz than anything else.
Yeah, I think I remember that about you. Who's your favorite or best album, best artist? Do you have a go-to?
I really love John Coltrane.
Okay. This is coming from someone who is somewhat of a, I've just never gotten into jazz, not gotten into, never really spent the time to really explore. So but I don't know what a good starting point, I don't know what the...
But I love world music too. Yeah. I mean, I listen to a huge amount of world music. There's a sort of music from the Rajasthan deserts in northern India called Qawwali music. It's devotional music with, six, seven, eight people sit down and, you know, they have a couple of drums and they have these beautiful little hand organs that they use. And it's just absolutely transcendent music. So
if we come to your office, will we find you blasting this in the background?
You won't find it blasting in the background, but you will find it playing in the background.
That's great. You know, I go through cycles on that. There's times when I'll be listening to music almost throughout the day, but I feel like it's very cyclical for me. I didn't go months without doing it. I need to start plugging some in. The Spotify has a pretty decent random called Discover Weekly that they look at your music.
Yes, I know about this.
And it's pretty good. I mean, I think I need to update some of my music because it ends up giving me the same sort of stuff all the time. But I think that's a pretty good resource.
I have a shorter musical mm-hmm. cycle than you. Mm-hmm. I go in and out, you know, listening to music on a much shorter term. Mm-hmm. Like I'll listen for a few hours and then I have to think and
such. What's a go-to resource if someone wanted to build their own, you say vacuum tube amp? Is that how you describe it?
Yeah, there's a very popular board, internet message board called DIY, Do-It-Yourself Audio.
Hmm.
And it's filled full of people.
And so can you buy, like, can you, is the stuff you can buy from like Crutchfield, or is it much more like boutique-y?
Today 15 years ago, you really couldn't buy tube amps. They were very rare specialty items, but they become really popular again. So today, any decent hi-fi store will have a selection of tube amps in
stock. Just not Radio Shack anymore, right?
Not Radio Shack anymore. The question is, where do you get the tubes? That's the question everybody asks. And tube manufacturers are starting up again. The key was is that Russia used tubes in their technology much, much later into the game. Even, you know, like the middle range MiG fighters had tubes in them. So they kept tube factories running far later into history than the West. So there have been some vacuum tube resources maintained. Now China is becoming a vacuum tube manufacturer, and there's a new vacuum tube factory in Germany now.
Where are your travels taking you next? Are you here for a little bit? Are you getting out of the rain, going somewhere?
Next, I'm going to Japan. I'm going to visit a couple of the southern islands. I want to kind of get away from it for a little while.
There's one of the southern islands that I've seen photos of, and it looks like a Caribbean island. It's unbelievably beautiful. I've spent a handful of trips to Japan, but it's been mostly in the North, skiing on the mainland and then up in Hokkaido, but have never gone south. And one of those southern islands looks absolutely gorgeous. I can't remember the name of it off my head, so we'll have to download later and see what you thought about it. Anywhere else? Is that the main for 2017?
No. That's my next trip. After that, it'll probably be back to Euroland in the middle of the year.
Well, good. Go kick up the animal spirits. We are bullish on European equities, so in particular Eastern Europe. So,
but my big trip from last year was Tasmania, which I recommend highly to anybody. It was fantastic.
Good wine.
Nice people. Beautiful place. Clean.
I almost hopped over there. It was down in Melbourne and Torquay for an investment conference.
Just take the ferry.
I was either gonna take that road towards Adelaide. I'm gonna murder the pronunciation, or go to Tasmania. And I think they even have some fly fishing in Tasmania. I may get that wrong.
Oh no, they have a lot of fly fishing.
And so now I'm having a little bit of regret that I didn't go. But I travel a fair amount. That I was finally like, you know what, I'm just going to set up shop in a city for a few days, relax. And so I just kind of hung out in Melbourne and pretended like I was a local, and just kind of went to the coffee shop, joined a local gym, and worked. But the funny thing about a lot of Australia is a very similar vibe to California. And Tasmania, I think, is even more remote than most of the places.
Tasmania is actually pretty remote, but the key is that it's relatively unpopulated. That the population density is very low, so people aren't frenetic. You know, they don't have that big city vibe to them at all. They're warm and welcoming, and they live in a sort of, you know, or reasonable life pace and such like that. Good. The food's good. The scenery's extraordinary.
Yeah. All right. Well, on the to-do
and pristine
to-do list, John. Thanks so much for coming by today. I don't want to take up any more time. Where can people go? They want to find more information.
Sort of go-to site is BollingerBands.com. Mm-hmm. Has links to everything else that we have. If you're interested in Bollinger Band analytics, the go-to site is bbands.com, BBANDS.com.
And of course on Twitter, bbands. Talking about Bitcoin and why call. Look, thanks so much for coming out today, podcast listeners. We'll post all the show notes with links to many of these esoteric books, vacuum tube amplifiers, and everything else at mebfaber.com/podcast. You can always find the show notes and links there, as well as subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, my favorite listening app called Castro. Thanks for listening, friends, and good investing. Today's podcast is sponsored by Global Financial Data. We've been using data series from GFD for almost 10 years, ever since I wrote my first white paper. The data has been vital in our research in areas such as Cape ratio calculations and historical simulations. For almost 20 years now, Global Financial Data has been aggregating and transcribing data from original sources, with many sources no other data provider has published before. Please have a look at their website at globalfinancialdata.com for more info and to set up a trial account. If you mention that I sent you, they're offering a 20% discount on all new business subscriptions. Again, that's globalfinancialdata.com.